yourself a song to sing, and sing it till you're done. Yes, sing it hard and sing it well. Send the robber barons straight to hell. The greedy thieves who came around and ate the flesh of everything they found, whose crimes have gone unpunished now, walk the streets a screaming now.
Greetings, all you 99%ers. This is your host, Dr. Jack Rasmus. This is Alternative Visions. Okay, as we've indicated throughout the week, today's show will be dedicated to discuss events, conditions in Venezuela and the counter-revolution there underway. We have a very important guest, a journalist from Venezuela, in Venezuela right now is Pablo Vivanco, but he's having a little trouble getting through, not surprising, to the show. Hopefully he will be able to get on the show, and we can turn to him immediately and let him tell us what's actually going on. You know, the media is very unreliable, the U.S. media. The prostitutes, you know, press prostitutes, the prostitutes, as Paul Craig Roberts likes to call them. Washington Post, New York Times, Wall Street Journal, Barron's, all those guys are really cooking the books, the fact books, with regard to what's going on over there. So you're not going to get a good view of what's actually happening if you read the general elite press in this country. And that's why we're trying to get people who are actually involved on the ground over there and have them tell us what's really happening, both in terms of the counter-revolutionary efforts underway by the economic elites and efforts, strategic and tactical, to counter those efforts by Venezuela popular government and people and popular assemblies and so forth. Okay, so hopefully Pablo will be able to join us. We'll see. Certainly hope he can get on here, but if not, we'll just continue ourselves. What does this counter-revolution really reflect, both in terms of U.S. policy and in terms of global conditions here, is really the question. I've been covering Latin America from time to time in some of my articles. I write periodically for Telesur Media out of Caracas and Quito, Ecuador, articles on the global economy and U.S. political economy for them. And for the last couple of years, periodically, I've indicated that, this counter-revolution is being planned and intensifying over there, and of course now it's full-blown. Actually, you know, the U.S. elites have never accepted Venezuela's Bolivarian Revolution, as it's called, since the time that the late Hugo Chavez, an ex-military general, progressive, turned the country into a popular democratic direction, won elections. He was, of course, anathema to the U.S. political and economic elites, never really accepted the changes there in Venezuela in a decade or so ago, and the democratic revolution there, even though it continued, the U.S. continued to buy oil from them. Prior, of course, to 2008-09, the U.S. was heavily dependent on imported oil, and Venezuela was an important area. And the refining companies in Venezuela, Exxon and others, had a deep economic interest in monopolies there. Venezuela nationalized its crude oil production and in steps took over the refinery operations as well and turned that massive source of income, global oil, before 2008 into democratic popular spending on education and health care and a lot of other areas, and raised the standard of living significantly for most of the population. Venezuela is one of the poorest countries in terms terms of income distribution before the revolution. Massive, massive wealth for 2-3% of the population. They took all that oil wealth, and very, very little got distributed to the people until the Chavez revolution, and then it got redistributed more so than before, raised the poverty levels, raised the standard of living, and so forth. But it really agitated the economic interests, both domestic and foreign, who had to redistribute some of that wealth and share some of that wealth. And attempts have been made over time for crude counter-revolutions in the streets and so forth that have never prevailed because of popular support and continuing support of the military from which Chavez came for the regime there. In 2008 and 2009, of course, and before that, the U.S. was distracted. U.S. policy was distracted from Latin America, preoccupied with what was going on in the Middle East. Of course, you know, Afghanistan, 9/11, Afghanistan, Iraq, and after that, you know, the whole North Africa, Middle East area, Iran, and Libya, and Syria, and Yemen now, and so forth. So the U.S. Focused on that region in terms of policies and so forth. But then under Obama, as his term began to come to a close, Obama, of course, recognized that the U.S. was too preoccupied with the Middle East, and it was losing ground in both in Asia to China and Latin American democratic revolutions and governments were rising. And the U.S. doesn't like that either. So in about 2015, 14, 15, Obama clearly initiated what was called the Asian pivot. We were going to move forces from the Middle East preoccupation and to Asia. And, of course, not announced, but part of that reorientation and shift was the U.S. to focus once again on Latin America and clean up those democratic governments and get the compliant economic elites back in the saddle there in the government and running the show, give them a nice piece of the action economically. And that's the way the U.S. had controlled Latin America for decades going on. In cooperation with wealthy economic elites supported by the U.S. and multinational corporations and U.S. banks, international banking, and so forth. So there was this shift, 2015, both to Asia and Latin America. The U.S., I would argue, had achieved what it wanted, Plan B, in the Middle East. Plan A, of course, would have been to essentially take over those governments in the Middle East and install economic satrapies friendly to the United States and to U.S. economic interests. That was Plan A. It didn't work out that way, of course. But Plan B was, if you can't engineer very compliant domestic elites in the Middle East that would be appendages of U.S. economic political policy, well, then the alternative is to leave it in a condition of regional conflicts, intensifying conflicts where everybody is fighting everybody else locally, and that way manipulate one group against another group and keep those economies and countries pretty much dependent on the West in various ways. And of course, the big cards the U.S. plays in the Middle East is Israel and Saudi Arabia. They do the dirty work for the U.S. interests, as we see in Yemen now. So the U.S. had decided pretty much, I think, a couple of years ago that the best they could do was to leave the whole place in shambles and therefore any opposition, any realignments going on there with in that region, those countries either with Iran or China or Russia, okay? And to shift once again to the more critical U.S. International interests, which are Latin America and Asia right now. The main reason the U.S. Preoccupied so deeply in the Middle East is because European capitalists and elites are no longer economically or politically capable of controlling that area, which was always their jurisdiction, or controlling Africa, which was the jurisdiction. The U.S., of course, has moved into Africa now as well, playing the key role there. In the post-World War II period, it was, okay, Europe, Africa is yours, particularly, you know, French and British, and the Middle East is yours to control. But clearly by 1960s, 70s, they did not have the wherewithal or the will to really control those areas, and the U.S. has had to slip in increasingly to play the key role in the Middle East. Well, you know, you can't fight even a diplomatic war, let alone a hot war on three fronts. Okay, this is Jack Rasmus. I'm back again. It looks like we had a little trouble with the phone connections here. I was in the middle of explaining a U.S. policy shift from the Middle East to Latin America and Asia in the last couple years here, and I believe our guest, Pablo Vivanco, who I introduced at the beginning of the show, is back on here. Pablo, are you with us?
Yes, I am, Jack. Thanks for having
okay. me. Okay, wonderful. We had a little disruption here. I think it was the phone connections as you called in here. It flipped something, and we got this crazy music. I don't know where that came from. In any event, maybe they can edit it out here when we podcast the show. In any event, just to summarize where we were, I was talking about, waiting for Pablo, talking about U.S. global policy and how it never really accepted the Bolivarian Revolution in Venezuela and how it was distracted by Middle East issues and concerns from focusing on continuing policy and repression in Latin America, and it allowed some democratic revolutions to slip in Latin America, particularly in Brazil, Argentina, and Venezuela, and a few other places, while the U.S. was preoccupied here with the Middle East issues, with Iran and Iraq and all the other conflicts, Libya, Yemen now, and so forth. But U.S. elites around 2015 had decided that you know, they weren't going to be able to totally exercise hegemony in the Middle East, and the best bet was to keep the whole place afire and you know, fighting amongst itself while the U.S. Shifted its policy to what it considered more important global international long-term interest in Asia, and turned once again to cleaning up, as it would say, the democratic revolutions in Latin America. That occurred around 2015. You can read some of my articles at the time, jackrasmus.com on my blog, or I even wrote a few for Telesur at the time, predicting that the shift was coming now, and the focus of the U.S. policy would be to intervene more aggressively once again in Latin America and to turn those democratic revolutions back to the right-wing economic interests and elites. It's succeeded in doing so in Argentina, of course. It succeeded in putting the Macri government back in control over there and making sure that the U.S. hedge funds and vulture funds got paid, which the democratic government there refused to do, overpaid from debt, earlier debt policies by the hedge funds. So as soon as Macri got in power, first thing he did was make sure the Argentine government, who couldn't afford it, paid off the U.S. hedge funds. And then he was welcomed and invited to New York, which he immediately went to and got some big, big loans, which the elites down there are going to skim the lion's share off the top, make themselves rich again, and debt that country again, which has already happened. And then we had the case of Brazil, where once again, you know, we had a efforts to wreck the economy by U.S. and international economic institutions and by controlling the central bank. And then, of course, you blame the government for that, and you use that economic disruption to try to engineer a counter coup and so forth. What we see throughout Latin America now and Venezuela, the latest example, is how the U.S. and the elites, the bankers, multinational corporations, purposely try to undermine an economy and create the conditions for a political regime change. How do they wreck the economy? Well, a number one means by tactic by which they do it is to get the central bank in these countries, which are tied in with close relations with U.S., you know, the IMF and the World Bank and U.S. Federal Reserve Fund and so forth, to get the central bank in these countries to jack up interest rates to double-digit levels, which precipitates a deep recession. We've seen that happen in clearly in Argentina, especially in Brazil. The central bank of Brazil wrecked that economy starting several years ago. Those high rate increases also undermine the currency, which means you have a significant inflation increase, particularly in imported goods for food and medical goods and so forth. And then you can blame the recession and unemployment and the runaway inflation on the government, you know, the Democratic government. You get the U.S. banks to withdraw credit. And that undermines investment and deepens the recession, right? And then you get U.S. multinational companies to withdraw currency, dollars, from these economies. The dollars are needed to buy critical imports. You know, most of these countries are heavily dependent on imports, particularly for food and medical stuff and so forth, and that generates shortages. If you don't have the money, the dollars to buy in international markets, the medical goods and so forth, you get shortages and you blame the government for that too. And then you get the media in the government to focus on corruption. And that takes all the economic conditions and it focuses it on the government as the cause. And that was a big play in Brazil and Argentina, and they're trying to do that in Venezuela now as well. And another way you get the money out of the dollars out of the economy is not only to put pressure on multinational corporations not to put money in the economy and to take their money out of the economy. In the case of Venezuela, the U.S. has promoted websites in Colombia and encouraged people to take their dollars and invest across the border there. And then you get opposition, you finance opposition parties to take over the legislatures. And you use the legislatures to neutralize the courts, and then you indict government leaders and try to force new elections. You try to neutralize the police and the army by promoting street conflicts to create violence and instability. It makes it look like the government can't provide domestic safety, right? Then you try to buy off some of the key army leaders and media folks and even people you know, within the legislature. Freeze offshore assets, impose new economic sanctions that have just occurred in Venezuela, targeting oil in particular. It's number one source of government income. Oil income in Venezuela provides like 95 or 97% of all government revenues. All right, so if you're going to cut off oil, you're going to cut off the revenues even more. And then you prosecute key leaders once you take over or even kill them. That's the strategy. You see, that's how it works. And the U.S. has employed this strategy time and time again in Latin America and elsewhere. And now it's turning the screws attempting to do that in Venezuela. It's already succeeded in doing that in Brazil and Argentina. If it can pull it off in Venezuela, then all the smaller countries in Latin America will fall in place as well. So the struggle going on in Venezuela is key for the entire continent, really. You know, if they can pull it off in Venezuela, then they've recaptured the entire continent and opposition, popular opposition to the elite takeovers in Argentina and Brazil. Will suffer a defeat as well. So Argentina is key, and they know it. And clearly under Trump, we've got an intensification of the attack. It's more overt now. And, Trump has come out and said military action may be possible. And Vice President Pence is threatening Venezuela as well. Where we are right now, it seems to me, is that the counter-revolution is attempting even more aggressively, but there seems to be some interesting attempts by the popular revolution government, Maduro government there in Venezuela, to check this. Right, in order to pull off the counter-revolution, you got to take over the courts. And you got to take over the legislature and create what's called a dual power situation where you have the government, the executive, but the opposition has the other institutions, the courts and the legislature. Well, they took over the legislature in Venezuela, but they haven't been able to take over the courts yet. And there hasn't been major defections from the police or the army, even though there's been intensification of efforts to do that. And there still are popular organizations in Venezuela, grassroots organization, and then most recently this very creative, counter response by the Maduro popular government to create a constituent assembly. In other words, the dual power, which is always an indication of a revolutionary situation, in this case a counter-revolutionary situation with the conservative business interests taking over the legislature. You've got a partial dual power there. But the government has recently had a constituent assembly election, overwhelmingly a new legislature. So it's created a dual power to the dual power. And that's where it seems to me the real action is politically. In Venezuela at the time, and the election of the Constituent Assembly has caused deep heartburn to U.S. Interests and to the local elites there trying to overthrow the government because they didn't anticipate that. And now that's where the battle is, it seems to me. Anyway, that's just my analysis from afar, someone who's really not, on the street there, understanding what's going on. It's my best guess of what's happening. But we do have a guest here. I'm going to shut up now. We do have a guest, Pablo Vivanco, who is a journalist, a well-known journalist, and deeply involved. I'm not sure if you are a Venezuelan nationalist or not, Pablo, but I'm sure, working down there, you have a view of what's going on that we're certainly not getting in the prostitute media here, prostitute media called prostitutes. Some of us are calling it now, New York Times and Washington Post and those folks. And I've invited you here to give us a local view, of what's actually happening down there in terms of the counter-revolution, in terms of the Constituent Assembly, in terms of the conditions, and whatever else you want. Give us educate our listeners here as to what's actually happening down there. I'm going to shut up now. That's a lengthy intro.
Well, just as a beginning for a disclosure, I'm actually not Venezuelan by origin. I'm Chilean by origin, but I've been extensively in Venezuela, and right now I'm based out of Quito, Ecuador, which is where I'm the director of Telesur English, and that's where we're based out of. Obviously, you know, the very, very close, and, you know, you've been talking a lot about what's happening in the region, not just in Venezuela, because it's difficult to just talk about Venezuela in isolation from what's happening within the region. Well, in Venezuela as a whole, as you've been kind of describing there since the beginning of the Bolivarian Revolution in 98, there have been internal and external attempts to try to suffocate it, stifle it, and obviously overthrow it as well. These actions have accelerated over the last couple of years because of a number of different things, including, you know, you spoke about the what's been happening on the international markets and the decline of commodities, particularly oil, and the impact that that has on Venezuela as a major oil producer, but also one that suffers from an extreme case of Dutch disease. So it's very, very much dependent on oil, and also as a result, dependent on imports, and you know that has a whole bunch of other things that it entails. And so now we see you know, from the part of the U.S. financial structure, efforts to try to limit its access to credit, limit its ability to exchange on the international market. Last year, Citibank announced that it would close Venezuela's accounts. Venezuela has tried to reissue bonds, a number of other things, which, you know, generally any other country or, you know, entity like the ones that belong to Venezuela, like PDVSA, a state-owned oil company, could do and not really raise a lot of eyebrows. But, you know, because it's Venezuela and it's because of its connection to the Bolivarian Revolution, has faced things that, you know, otherwise other countries wouldn't have to face. So now you have situations like a PDVSA boat has been off the coast of the U.S. For a couple months now without being able to dock because the U.S. banks will not release the information that they need to U.S. Customs so that the boat can dock and offload its cargo, which is obviously oil. You have situations like Venezuela not being able to, facing similar things to what the last days of the Kirchner government, the Fernandez government rather, in Argentina faced, with not being able to pay its bondholders, even though it had liquidity to do so, but because it's faced with financial impediments to be able to just interact normally with the market. So Venezuela now, you have over the last month, I don't know how many airline companies saying that they wouldn't fly to Venezuela anymore. You're seeing a very now public element of what the government over there has been calling a financial war, an economic war rather, against the country, which people over there have been seeing because of the shortages. Obviously, it has a different local dimension when we're talking about shortages, hoarding, speculation of currency, as you also explained, because of the different exchanges that the country has, and also because of how that exchange is interacting on the country's borders, particularly in Colombia, but also in Brazil. In Colombia, where the government allows exchange houses on the border of Venezuela to exchange at a different currency than the Central Bank of Colombia allows. So people are making fortunes on turning around Venezuelan currency, buying it at the borders, going to Bogota or other places and exchanging it, and then just continuing a cycle like that. So the situation has been difficult. It's got the financial component, the economic component that we're talking about, the political component, which exacerbated with the death of Hugo Chavez, obviously the leader of the Bolivarian Revolution, and you know the things that have come thereafter. with the economic war, the impact that that's had on the Venezuelan people obviously translates into elections and what the electorate is feeling and wanting to do, understandable frustrations with people from seeing difficulties in their day-to-day, resulted in the 2015 December parliamentary election victory for the opposition, who won a majority of the seats. But since then, there's obviously been an institutional crisis that's been created, a very similar institutional crisis if you look back in history to the Allende period from 1970 to 73, where there was also an institutional impasse between the executive and the legislature. So in Venezuela right now, what you've had happen since the opposition took over the legislature is an opposition. The opposition has tried to pass laws which the Supreme Court has overruled as being unconstitutional. Now, obviously, what's being portrayed in a lot of the media is that this is the Chavista-controlled Supreme Court knocking down things that the democratically elected legislature has tried to do. And obviously, what's missing from that is what has actually been the basis of those laws that have been shut down. So part of the among the first things that the opposition tried to do was to use the legislature in order to remove Maduro, the president of Venezuela, Nicolas Maduro, who was elected in 2014. So immediately what they tried to do is certain things like having him declared to be Colombian. Obviously people in the U.S. will be familiar with the whole truther, birther movement rather, against Obama. Well, a similar thing happened in Venezuela, where the opposition people have been long suggesting, that without any proof, obviously, that Maduro, is actually Colombian, was actually born in Colombia, and therefore not eligible constitutionally to be president. They also tried to retroactively reduce Maduro's term. So basically, through the legislature, change the constitutional term of the president from 6 years to 4 years. Obviously, those are the type of things that any country would declare unconstitutional and illegal, regardless of whether, you know, and one political force controls it or not. At least among many observers, has been seen as something deliberate to try to create an institutional impasse, which, you know, we see actually until today, the impasse between the National Assembly controlled by the opposition and other elements of other powers of the Venezuelan state. And obviously, over the last while, particularly with the Trump administration, not that the Obama administration was hands-off when it came to Venezuela. Obviously, President Obama himself issuing an executive decree declaring Venezuela a threat to U.S. national security, which has a whole slew of implications if folks are familiar with the other times when countries have been declared a threat to U.S. national security and what's happened with those countries. But since the Trump administration came into fold, obviously these actions have continued, and at least the rhetoric has really accelerated, coming to last week when President Trump said that he is willing to taking off the table the use of a military option or military operations. He used both those terms in that press conference. Now, obviously, other aspects of the Trump administration, Mike Pence, who went through four countries in Latin America this week, tried to really distance himself and say that still a peaceful option was available in Venezuela. But, you know, in every country that he visited in Latin America, Colombia, Argentina, Chile, and Panama, he spoke about that the Trump administration will be looking to try to apply further pressure in the form of sanctions and other things to Venezuela. So obviously, the pressure's on. The Trump administration and its regional allies, obviously Colombia, Argentina, and Mexico, was also talked about. Mike Pompeo said that the U.S. administration was working particularly closely with Mexico and with Colombia on its policies towards Venezuela. Right now, they're seeing this as the time to try to pressure to crack and in their hopes to overthrow the Bolivarian Revolution and the government currently at the helm in Venezuela, which obviously has the would have the regional implication of being the the last bastion of the left in Latin America from what a lot of folks have called the pink tide, which has suffered electoral defeats over the last couple of years. I think there's a view of Venezuela as really the linchpin in that regional movement, since now Brazil has turned, because of the parliamentary coup, and also the Macri government still seems to be actually firmly at the helm following the primaries this week, where they actually had an unexpectedly good showing for the parties and candidates connected to the Macri government.
You mentioned sanctions and intensifying that are further coming, and you mentioned this fellow Pompeo, by the way, for the listeners, he's the head of the U.S. CIA, and if the CIA is now working closely with Mexico and Colombia, and the U.S. has declared Venezuela a national security threat, what that means, I think, is a signal that the CIA and the deep state in the U.S. is going to intensify its disruptive effects in Venezuela, and they're going to use Mexico and Colombia as key conduits and assistance in that regard. So, Pompeo, CIA, that means we're moving to a higher stage. I know they're talking about possibility of preventing U.S. exports, and as you've indicated, they're preventing oil imports from Venezuela. They're holding up the ships and won't let them unload and so forth. So this all represents a further economic squeeze on Venezuela. Can you comment a little bit, Pablo, on the Constituent Assembly, what that represents and why it's causing the opposition so much heartburn?
Sure. Obviously, with the Venezuela's seen a few constitutional assemblies in the last couple of decades, something that most countries are unfamiliar with. Obviously, the U.S. hasn't had any. Had some constitutional reform, but I mean, it's had a constitution in place for a couple hundred years. Other English-speaking parts of the world, the UK, Canada, don't have constitutions, so it's an unfamiliar concept to a lot of people. What the Constitutional Assembly is, it's a mechanism that's currently outlined in the Venezuelan Constitution that can be called either by the Venezuelan populace or by the president. It's important to note that, because there's been people within Venezuela, the opposition, and also this is part of the rationale for sanctions and for some of the aggressions and threats from other governments, that this body is illegal. Well, it's actually not illegal. It's outlined very clearly in Article 347, 348, and 349 of the Bolivarian Constitution, that there's certain ways that this body can be called in order to begin the process for creating a new constitution or for constitutional reform. So Maduro, on May Day, on May 1st, invoked the article that allows him to call this. So what we had on July 30th was an election for the 545 delegates from representing both territories and sectors to draft a constitution that will be put back to popular referendum. Again, another important aspect that ultimately whatever is drafted by these folks is going to be put back to the Venezuelan people to either approve or reject. So this mechanism was invoked by Maduro as a way to try to, in his words, address the restore peace, right, and restore the sort of institutionality within the country that hasn't been working within for the last couple of years because of this impasse. And also, I think a lot of people are familiar with the scenes of violence in Venezuela over the last couple of months since early April, when the opposition started calling for street demonstrations, and you know the chaotic scenes from there, the lynchings, the horrible things that happened since then. So now what you have is the Constitutional Assembly is in place.
Is it called a Constitutional Assembly or Constituent Assembly?
Constituent Assembly. It's a national Assembly. So the Constituent Assembly is in place now. It is moving forward both with the drafting of the new constitution, but because this Constitutional Assembly has a specific authority to be kind of like a superpower over the government while it's in the process of drafting the constitution, it's been going through a process over the last couple of weeks of also trying to situate itself within the other powers of government, right? So it's had meetings with the Supreme Court officials, with the National Electoral Council, with the Ombudsperson, which is a specific constitutional power under the Venezuelan constitution. Obviously, the President's Office, and today supposed to have it called the National Assembly to meet with it, so that basically that institutionality could be restored, and there could be some level of cooperation between both the National Assembly and the Constituent Assembly. The National Assembly, as I already said, is not in a position where it's cooperating with the other branches of power. That's because it sees and it proclaims the other branches of power to be under Chavista control. So therefore, it's basically gone into a position of not recognizing any of the other powers. So one thing that happened today is the Constituent Assembly has said that it, in the absence of the National Assembly doing its job, that it would basically undertake legislative actions. Basically, because it's saying that the National Assembly is not in a legal position to undertake its functions.
Some of those are probably going to be worked out as
we kind of see how all of this develops. But the important thing with this Constituent Assembly is that it actually has resulted, if you've seen, since July 30th, there haven't been the same street demonstrations that we saw for the previous close to 4 months. And we haven't, on our side, as journalists, had to report on deaths as we were seeing, almost on a daily basis from the previous 4 months. So on some level, some of the promises that this Constituent Assembly would restore some level of order in the country have turned out to be working, at least so far. Obviously, again, the hope from all of this, at least from the side of the government, is that this will ultimately result in not only a final constitution that can address some of the deficits of the government and of the Bolivarian Revolution, but that it can also create a dialogue between political actors in the country so that there could be some sort of restoration of order that really just hasn't been present for the last while.
Well, that's very interesting. You know, our listeners should think of the Constituent Assembly that's been called and elected there in Venezuela as very similar to the U.S. Constitutional Assembly. You might call it an assembly, U.S. Constitutional Congress, which met in 1787 in the U.S. in order to reform the U.S. Assembly, the U.S. National Assembly that existed in the sense in the states during the Articles of Confederation. I mean, it's not unlike what the U.S. went through in the 1780s. You know, we had a government, we had legislatures, it wasn't working, there was a lot of conflict with the grassroots and between the grassroots and the economic elites. So the U.S. Constitutional Convention in Philadelphia was called in order to develop a new constitution in order to settle some of the problems which had to do, by the way, with bond payments, with access to unsold land, with the ability to collect taxes, and so on and so forth. What's going on there in Venezuela is not any different than what went on in the U.S. In its early formation. You know, your first constitution maybe didn't work as well because it was put together under conditions that have dramatically changed, and you need to reform it. Well, that's what we did at Philadelphia in 1787. It's really no different. There's historical parallel there. You know, just for the listeners to keep that in mind. And it's interesting, you know, that you point out the Constituent Assembly just elected had a basis to be formed in your pre-existing constitution. It wasn't something that's been called that is totally contradictory to your previous constitution. It really comes out of that constitution. So it really has, you know, legal support and precedence, it seems to me. But what I think is going to be very interesting, and maybe you can comment on it, Pablo, is what happens once the Constitutional Assembly there starts drafting legislation that your National Assembly refused to do. Who do you think the people are going to follow? Which legislative bodies?
Well, that's kind of something that remains to be seen. Obviously, this is part of the situation that is currently present in Venezuela. You have a high level of polarization. So the opposition obviously has its followers. It has its people that it's been able to mobilize, and its people that have voted for it. Chavismo, in spite of all of the difficulties that the country is facing, the shortages, the speculation, the inflation, all those type of things, which obviously are severely impacting people. It still has people that mobilize because of the fact that they believe in the process that the Bolivarian Revolution has meant for them over the last almost two decades. And they still believe that this thing has a future. So neither is really going to go away. It hasn't gone away for the previous 18 years. There's no reason why it's going to go away in the next one or two or 5 years. Those things are still going to remain as political forces. Right now, this is one of the reasons why the more kind of balanced perspectives within the region and elsewhere have been calling for dialogue and have been insisting on dialogue, because you are unlikely to have a situation where one side is going to squash the other, right, or is going to absolutely eliminate the other from the political scene. That's not something that could happen without a significant amount of bloodshed, which is not something that I think anybody wants to see. So the Constituent Assembly, though, was able to, the vote on July 30th was able to get out a significant number of people. The government is saying it has put forward that the over 8 million people voted. That's a surprising figure, I think, for most observers. Obviously, the opposition has tried to say that's a fraudulent number. Of course, they aren't really providing any numbers for it. And even the company who owns the election, the machines that Venezuela uses for its election system, came out saying that the numbers were tampered with, without actually providing any basis for where they came up with any numbers, because they actually don't have access to those numbers. So it's a very dubious thing for that company to have come out the way that they did, when they did, without actually talking with Venezuelan authorities about whatever concerns that they may have had as a client of Venezuela's electoral authority. But nonetheless, regardless of what the actual number was, I think everybody recognizes that in spite of the difficulties, Chavismo is still there. But the opposition is still there, too. The Constituent Assembly is going to draft a constitution which is going to be put to vote within a few months. This is not a process that's going to drag out for years. So at that point, we'll see how many people turn out to vote. We'll see if people approve that or not. That's the other aspect to this, is that Venezuelans are going to have the right to vote yes or no to this thing, right? And if they want this to be the constitution of their country, if they want this text to be the legal framework for their country to operate under. And following that, I think we'll kind of have a clear picture of, you know, what's going to be, what the alignment of forces are at that time.
Well, you indicate popular, 8 million popular support for this constituent assembly idea. In the media here in the U.S., all we're getting is reports of massive demonstrations against the government. But are there equivalent popular demonstrations for the government there that we're not hearing about?
Absolutely. Just this week, right? Chavismo is still able to turn out on a regular basis tens of thousands of people. The opposition, to their credit, over the last year since September, have had a couple of also massive marches. However, their ability to a lot of the demonstrations, a lot of the things that have been reported over the last 4 months, these anti-government demonstrations that most of them have turned violent, you see these pictures from shots that make it look like there's tens of thousands of people on the street. You get an aerial view, and it's at best a couple thousand people. The majority of these things, however, have been these focal points of dozens of massed opposition people basically creating roadblocks and then just, having a back and forth, a tit for tat with the National Guard over a period of a couple of hours in an intersection or in a section of a highway, but certainly not mass demonstrations. That's not to say, again, I'm not saying that the opposition hasn't mobilized mass demonstrations. They absolutely have. But Chavismo also has mobilized tens of thousands, sometimes hundreds of thousands of people in some of their demonstrations. And obviously, those are the type of things which are not being shown to most people outside. This is where the narrative of an unpopular government is being constructed. Right now, most governments in the region are actually not popular. Because of the economic conditions with the fall in the price of commodities, most governments are facing financial crunches, and this is coming down to the populace. But if you compare the Maduro's popularity levels, they're actually higher than a lot of other presidents in Latin America right now. And that's the irony of all this thing, right? That you have certain governments in Latin America that are calling Venezuela's government undemocratic, saying Maduro should step down. And those presidents that are making these statements actually have a lower level of popularity than Maduro.
Certainly the business-led Temer government in Brazil, where Temer, I think, has single-digit popularity. We don't hear about that very, very much. That kind of supports the point.
But not only him. There's also Juan Manuel Santos in Colombia, Michelle Bachelet in Chile, Enrique Peña Nieto in Mexico. They have dismal levels of popularity, right? And again, in each one of those countries, there are perhaps different reasons for that. All those countries have been significantly impacted by what's happened on the from commodities drops over the last couple of years. But nonetheless, these governments are the ones that at the OAS at other forums are the ones that are perhaps speaking most about Venezuela. And in all those countries, you still have also significant social issues that their governments are that the people in those countries are demanding that their government address. In Colombia, there were massive demonstrations in the Afro-Colombian areas over the last couple of months. In Mexico, every couple of weeks, we see some horrific massacre that's taking place, and at the same time also massive demonstrations by different sectors in Mexico calling for their government to act on certain things, whether it be education in the case of Oaxaca last year, the journalist situation. There's been almost a half dozen journalists killed in Mexico this year alone, and then there's Chile, who for the last decade or so has had tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of students, teachers on the streets trying to get the government to react to the situation of the education system in the country.
Yeah, if you want to talk about government's a record in terms of providing domestic safety, and they refer to Venezuela, as at least the U.S. press does, as failing to provide domestic safety. Look at Mexico, where over 100,000 people have been killed in the last decade or so. 100,000. Talk about the failure of government to provide domestic safety for its citizens. Mexico is at the forefront of that. Can you also comment on the popular organizations in Venezuela? The Chavez Revolution relied heavily on these popular organizations. Are they still in effect and robust and in defense of the government, or are they sort of neutralized now?
No, I definitely wouldn't say that they're neutralized. Over the last two decades, obviously there's been different cycles when you talk about popular organizations. Obviously, I think there was never perhaps a trade union dominated popular movement, but in terms of territorial organizations, those working within their neighborhoods, that's been particularly strong, and those are the type of things that have really flourished over the last couple of over the last few years, particularly since 2006. And they actually had a place within. I spoke about how the National Constituent Assembly is in part made up of territorial representation from municipalities, which is obvious, but as well as sectors. So you have people that were elected to represent their sector, that they were elected to represent the communal councils, which are these territorial based self-organized groups that have legal standing. They can apply for government money to address infrastructure needs in their communities, for example. I've been to places where the community councils have organized their own transit systems and have received buses from the central government, but the community themselves organizes everything from the routes to who's going to be the drivers and what they're going to get paid. But you also have representation from other sectors, from the LGBT community, from groups of representing people with disabilities, from women's organizations, student organizations, and these sectors have now representation, people that are supposed to be speaking for those people, for those sectors, about the issues that those sectors face and want to see addressed within a new constitution. So
where can people in the U.S. go to get some information as to what's happening with regard to Constituent Assembly or whatever that is reliable and not biased U.S. press sources here? Where could they go on the Internet if they wanted to follow up to find out and listen, read things that are actually happening there that are more accurate? Can you let us know that?
Sure.
Would it be Telesur? Well,
obviously, I guess I'd have to plug the organization that I work for, Telesur, telesurtv.net/English. We obviously cover it extensively. Venezuela analysis, I would also say.
Okay, well, we got a signal. We're running out of time. Boy, we could talk another hour. Pablo, I would like to call you back when this draft constitution reform is actually publicly made available. I hope you can come back and join us then. Okay, this is Alternative Vision, Jack Rasmus, next week.